The Wrath of Leviathan. The storm was slow to break, but fierce and unremitting when it came. The creditors had been closing in on him for years. The Dunning men were always hammering at the door for bills unsettled, for mortgages overdue, for taxes owed but never paid. Now, by the beginning of 1818, 30 months after the publication of the Great Map, and at a time when William Smith should by rights have been showered with dignities and rewards, came the first grim mention of the ultimate penalty, debtor's prison. James Brogden, the kindly MP who had tried to help Smith sell his fossil collection, was the first to make public his own anxiety in an urgent letter written in the middle of January. "Poor Smith's distress and importunity force me again to intrude this unpleasant subject on your notice," he wrote to the Treasury officials. "The annexed paper contains a statement of what he thinks are his claims. If you can settle his claim today and make a small advance on it, you will save him from arrest and enable him to resume his useful employment in the country." The Treasury got the message. An internal memo sped from one official to another. "Smith, the mapmaker, I mean the strata and fossil man, hopes to receive from the bounty of the Treasury some aid. I heard last night in the House of Commons that if he doesn't get that aid, he will be arrested tomorrow." The urgency of the appeal got through. A cheque for £30 was sent round to Buckingham Street the following morning. The bailiff on standby went away. The turnkey was stood down. William Smith was not compelled to appear before the bench on that cold January day, at least. He continued to work and to travel, notwithstanding the financial fuss. When next the Treasury wrote, on February the 12th, he was away in Monmouthshire. A letter from an official named George Harrison had some moderately good news, though only in a tidying-over sense. Providing that Smith delivered to the museum the very last part of his collection, a cache of specimens he had been hoarding for such a rainy day as this, a further payment of £100 would be granted. He had been handed £30 in January, and so when he arrived at the Treasury on March the 28th, he collected only the balance that was due, £70. This was the last payment to be made from His Majesty's government. There was no more in the kitty. So far as the current and pressing problem of debt was concerned, William Smith's luck was now fast running out. He had had the chance to cut and run, twice no less. Anyone other than Smith might well have taken one or other of these opportunities, both of them exceptional, both well suited to his talent. That he in the end refused both offers opened him up yet again to still more perfidy and ill-treatment. In the first instance, he was invited to apply for a job in Russia via no less an agency than the great Count Alexei Orlov, one of the heroes of the Russian campaign against Napoleon and an adviser to the Emperor Alexander I. Count Orlov had come to England on a diplomatic mission and to take the waters at Bath. While there, he instructed an aide, a certain Dr. Hamel, to make an official request for a British mineralogist to come to the southern part of the Russian Empire, most probably the Ukraine, to supervise the immense coal industry there. One of Smith's old friends from Bath, the Reverend Richard Warner, told Hamel about Smith, and for some weeks in 1815 the two men wrote to one another, with the Russian clearly offering Smith a career of wealth and honour. However, Smith, who at the time was arranging his fossils for the British Museum, mentioned the possibility of going to Russia to his contacts there, prompting them to respond that, providing that he turned the foreign offer down, he could be assured of an offer of a permanent and lucrative career with the museum. Not unnaturally, he immediately told Dr. Hamel, and via him, the visiting Russian count, that he regretted he couldn't take the job. But the museum, far from reacting with pleasure, and a consequent generosity of spirit, remained stiff and silent. No further offer was ever forthcoming. Thus was the disappointment that plagued Smith's life reinforced yet again. A year later still, he was offered another job, this time in the United States. He was asked, according to a note in his diary, though by whom we do not know, to survey, level, estimate, and report on the practicability of overcoming the falls on navigable rivers in North Carolina. But this offer he declined as well, without explanation. Knowing what history allows us to know today, and what would shortly befall him, It beggars belief that this troubled, unappreciated man did not slip out quietly on a westbound ship, heading for an infinitely better life in the new world. As it is, whether by commission or default his writings do not indicate, he opted to stay put in England and to stare down the gathering crisis. The law in relation to debt in London in the early years of the 19th century was clear enough, though, by today's lights, somewhat peculiar. Very basically put, a creditor who failed to get satisfaction from his debtor could apply to a court official, a bailiff, a man equipped with extraordinary summary powers, to have the debtor committed to one of the great London debtors' prisons, the Fleet, the Marshalsea, or the King's Bench. The former was on the east side of what is now Farringdon Street, near St. Paul's Cathedral. The two latter were across the Thames in the prison ghetto of Southwark. The peculiar aspect of the law, as seen today, is that there seems to be no logic or sense in imprisoning a man for debt, for then he's most certainly not going to be able to earn money to pay the debt off. But the custom of English common law had been savagely firm for centuries. A debtor taken in execution, which was the rather overly dramatic legal phrase then used for debt arrest, was to be kept in salva et stricta custodia until the debt was paid. The explanation for such a necessity is simple enough, and stems from the basic principle of the system, which held that, by arresting a debtor, his body had been seized in lieu of his estates. Until he had so arranged these estates that his creditor could be paid and satisfied, then his body would be entrusted to the safekeeping of a prison warden, hence in salva et stricta custodia, as guarantee. There was no concept of guilt or innocence in a debt prison. Rather, imprisonment for debt was seen as an evidence of failure, the failure of a debtor to pay what was owed, and the failure of a creditor to obtain what was owed. Legal scholars argued that the subsidiary intention of the ancient laws on indebtedness was simply to preserve a system of credit. Imprisonment was threatened as a deterrent, a means of ensuring that the credit necessary for commerce, the signing of bills to raise cash for custom, for example, continued to flow easily. Men of means would sign bills, it was argued, if they knew that those for whom they signed them would be imprisoned if the bill went unpaid. But the system was willfully misused by both creditors and their debtors, and it took a long while for more civilized laws to take effect. Only in 1759 did Parliament rule that a trader who was entirely without assets might declare himself bankrupt and go free. In that case, he was allowed £10 worth of personal goods, his bedding, his clothes, his tools, to ensure that he still had both dignity and the means of livelihood left. If he declared bankruptcy fraudulently, however, he'd be sentenced to hang. At the time William Smith became mired in his indebtedness, any more general reform of the debtor-prison system was still several years away. And when John Beresford, a noted advocate of the reformist agitations in the 17th century, wrote of this great and terrible Leviathan, who thus disturbs our peace and cracks the sinews of the body politic, he could have been writing just as easily about the mountain of debt that ensnared the nation as of the lamentable state of some of the prisons in which the debtors were placed. The magnificent copperplate script that appears at the bottom of the page of the commitment book of the King's Bench Prison for the year 1819, below the records of the imprisonment of the equally unfortunate Thomas Mackrell, Charles Dibdin the younger, Mary Ann Russell, and Thomas Smith, is brief indeed. All it says is, Number 19, William Smith, entered 11th June 1819 in discharge of his bail, at the suit of Charles Connolly, Esquire, oath £300 and upward, and was thereupon commanded by C. Abbott. If there is to be a villain in this piece, then it was Charles Connolly. He was the owner of Midford Castle in Somerset, and the holder of Smith's mortgage at Tucking Mill House. Connolly had been financially involved with Smith since 1798, when he helped him to buy the house and the small estate at Tucking Mill. He would have been involved in the refinancing that Smith had to arrange when buying the Coombe Down quarry, and he had borne the initial burden when, in 1815, Smith's misjudgment, or bad luck, as to the quality of the oolite there, precipitated the venture's collapse. He must have tried countless times during the following years to win some of the money back, but Smith's financial recklessness would have put paid to any hopes of his doing so. Inevitably, he's cast as the Scrooge of this story, as the pitiless landlord who consigned one who should have been a hero to years of humiliation and ruin. But then again, one can hardly blame a man who had been owed a formidable sum of money, the £300 and upwards of the suit, for 20 years, and now saw no prospect of it ever being repaid, heading off in exasperation to plead before the King's Bench for satisfaction, even if that satisfaction meant no more than to have Smith committed to prison and his goods sold by fiat of the court. Smith records all too dryly, with the detachment one might find in a geological field book, the events leading up to the day of his arrest. On May the 15th, he was looking over another nearby house in Buckingham Street, number 12, which was up for rent. It might have been cheaper. He might have wondered if he should move, or knew that he might soon have to. On June the 2nd, he sent a report, perhaps about the parlous state of his finances, to a firm called Doss and Company. His friend Brogden had come round a little earlier to tell him he should move something for me this day in the House of Commons. On the 4th, he was at the Court of Common Pleas in Westminster Hall, face to face with Connolly at last, debating the merits of the latter's various claims. The next day, Smith made out accounts and sent them to Sir G. Alderson. I found no G. Alderson listed, but there was a Sir John Alderson, reporter to the King's Bench at precisely this time, and it may well have been that this judge demanded of Smith that he produce his accounts to show just how severe his financial situation was. One thing was clear, however. Smith was in no sense a trader, a dealer in goods and chattels. Had he been so, he might have claimed protection under the 1759 bankruptcy legislation, as all traders owing more than £100 had a right to do. As it was, the judgment of the Court of Common Pleas was clear enough. Smith was found to be an insolvent debtor, and Connolly could have him committed to prison forthwith, and see that enough of his goods were sold so as to make up the sum that the court agreed was owed. The next day finds Smith working on colouring more of the county maps he had in the making. No mention is made in his diary of the court, of the debt, indeed of any sense of impending doom. But 2 days later, early on the cool and clear morning of Friday, June the 11th, 1819, the axe for which all had been grimly waiting finally fell. The bailiff duly arrived outside the door of the Buckingham Street house, armed with Connolly's court-approved warrant, signed and sealed by the officials at the Court of Common Pleas. There would and could have been no further argument. Smith knew he was finally compelled by all the majesty of English law to do as he was told. The bailiff and his charge would have ridden in the court post-chaise along beside the Thames, a confusing journey dodging among the wharves, since there would not be a Thames embankment built for another 40 years. They would cross the river either by way of what was officially called the William Pitt Bridge, Londoners called it Blackfriars, as they do officially today, or John Rennie's newly completed Southwark Bridge, to the borough. 15 minutes of patient trotting, and the carriage, with its myrmidon and his charge, would have drawn up outside the high brick walls and the formidable miseries of the King's Bench prison. London's three great debtors' prisons were private institutions, owned by corporations, run for profit, and with men in charge as wardens who could make an income of thousands a year. For one of the many puzzlements of the entire debt imprisonment system is that it cost money to be in prison. It cost the prisoner money to enter a debtor's prison and then to stay there, nearly £2 to get in, a scattering of other charges, such as the 6 shillings and 8 pence, due to the tip staff for his service at court, and payment of at least a shilling a week for an unfurnished room with the most basic kind of bedding. If the incoming prisoner was utterly without funds, or unwilling to part with whatever he had, he would be put into a chummage, a dormitory with fellow prisoners, with whom one lived closely together, as chums, that's where we get the word. It usually took only a few days of such discomfort and indignity for the prisoner to be persuaded of the good sense of moving to a private room, whereupon the warden would regard him as a source of revenue, treat him well enough, and offer him the kind of privileges that made many debtors think of the King's Bench and the Fleet prisons as comfortable hotel-like retreats where they could seek sanctuary from the pressing problems beyond the walls. Not that they were always pinioned behind bars and brick. There was an area around all debtors' prisons called the Rules, in which such prisoners as were trusted not to abscond were allowed to live and carry on their businesses, but to be free from harassment by those to whom they owed money. The precise circumstances of William Smith's stretch in prison can never be known. The King's Bench records are unhelpful. It was a private institution. Its officers had no incentive to keep records of much more than the prisoner's dates of admission and release. Smith himself has expunged from his diary all material relating to his time inside. His nephew, John Phillips, who tried to remain in the Buckingham Street house while his uncle was away, he was told by the court officials to leave, however, as the landlord promptly cancelled Smith's tenancy and bailiffs came in to seize his somewhat pathetic collection of personal property, made no mention of any predicament in the biography he was later to write. The horrors of his imprisonment and the miseries of his marriage remained the two great non-subjects in William Smith's own recorded life. All reference to them has been expurgated from his works, all muted, hidden, or efficiently bowdlerized, both from Smith's writings and from all other contemporary accounts. His prison walls were 15 feet high, topped with rows of sharp iron spikes. It was impossible for passers-by to see inside, and prisoners, even in the topmost rooms, couldn't see beyond the wall. Provided he paid, each man was given a cell 9 feet square. He could either remain there for his term or socialize, and if he chose to mingle, he'd likely find his fellow prisoners a congenial lot. The prison population, after all, comprised men and women who, because they had been loaned money, were by and large prosperous by nature and by habit. Debtors' prisons were generally populated by the middle classes, not by the criminal classes or the undeserving poor. The 20,000 prisoners for debt were, it was said, from the better strata of society, a phrase that William Smith would have found doubly ironic. There was ample food and plenty of grog. Visitors were allowed. Men with access to funds could have young women sent in for pleasure and amusement. And in the courtyards of the prison all manner of games were played. The King's Bench is known as one of the places where, thanks to the happy combination of high walls and a large population of bored and competitive men wondering what to do with them, the game of rackets was invented. Visitors might think they had entered a gymnasium or a pleasure garden. Since there was no enforced routine or attempt at punishment, inmates were free to do more or less as they pleased, and callers report on the games of ninepins going on, or wrestling matches, or on groups of inmates sitting in the sun under a tent, drinking beer. It was in the King's Bench that Mr. Micawber reminded David Copperfield of the debtor's maxim about annual income £20, annual expenditure £20, aught and six, result misery. But in reality, the life that Micawber lived, with the agreeable and gypsy-like dinners in the prison cells, the evident camaraderie of 200 men and women there cursed with similar situations, and the free and easy manner of the warden and his staff, was none too bad. And it has to be supposed that William Smith's 11 weeks in the prison were none too bad either, except for the shocking fact that so clever, decent, talented and hard-working a man was incarcerated there in the first place. Whether his by now very sickly wife visited, we cannot know. Nothing in the diaries left by John Phillips records a visit by either his aunt or by Phillips himself. Nor do either Sir Joseph Banks or James Brogden ever mention travelling across the river from their offices in Somerset House and Westminster, respectively, to see their friend in Southwark. Similarly, John Carey, who was on the brink of publishing a second volume of William Smith's Geological Atlas, seems either to have stayed away or merely remains silent on the matter of ever going down to see his mapmaker. But whether they did or not, the ordeal was over more rapidly than Smith must have supposed when first he went in. The commitment book records his leaving as matter-of-factly as if he were a guest at a hotel. Discharged 31st August 1819, per attorney. A lawyer had apparently called to say that the chief creditor, Charles Connolly, was now satisfied. Sufficient of Smith's goods and chattels had now been sold to meet the demands of the man from Midford Castle. There was no longer any need to keep Smith in custody as guarantor that this should happen. After 80 nights in one of the world's most notorious houses of detention, he was free to go. He was escorted from his cell to the main door, given back his belongings, and the gate swung open. He stepped out into the street and into the throng of the curious bystanders soon after first light. He arrived home in Buckingham Street to find the house locked and bolted and a court official at the door. His goods, this bailiff informed him coldly, were still being organized, filed, and valued. After some while he was permitted inside to get such of his papers as the court officials deemed valueless, and to take them away. Some of his more valuable papers, he learned, had indeed been sold, but to an anonymous friend, one imagines either Joseph Banks, John Ferry, or, as we shall soon see, William Fitton, who had then arranged for Smith to have them back. There was now no further point in his staying around. He sought out his wife, who had, in part as a consequence of these events, fallen savagely ill, and, according to contemporaries, was now near deranged. He also found his nephew, John Phillips, who had left a message to say where he was staying. The three of them went to Holborn, to the inn where the postilions gathered, and caught the Northern Mail, the overnight stage, bound for Yorkshire. It was a trying time. His first reaction was indeed one of embitterment, and he wrote savagely of his relief at turning his back at last on a capital city in which, he insisted, he had never been made welcome, in which unhappiness had attended almost all his days. "London quitted with disgust," we've already seen him note, and with sardonic pleasure, "the cheering fields regained." A while later, and his mood had become calmer, his manner more philosophical. He wrote a long, rambling, and at times barely coherent note to himself that he titled "Difficult Times Briefly Investigated by an Accurate Observer of Passing Events." It reflected with some poignancy on the brutality of life, on the trying nature of hard times. "Time will show that my geological labours are not properly the work of an individual, in my humble circumstances, but such as might be generously encouraged as public works, and my journeys of so many thousands of miles a year for 20 years, at great expense, had they been upon discoveries in the interior of Africa instead of England, might have been a national object." It was his later musings on the sad situation that are more memorable. Writing some 20 years after the events, he was able, quite succinctly, to compare his own fate with that of his fossils, which he knew had never been properly displayed, and which he felt were every bit as imprisoned in the bowels of the British Museum as he had been in his 9-foot cell in the King's Bench prison. "Little would anyone suspect," he wrote of the museum, "that in such premises there was a prison in which these innocent tell-tales of the true history of our planet were to be immured for a term of more than 21 years. The man and his fossils might be imprisoned, but his discoveries could not. The collection was lost, books and papers scattered, and he was deprived of everything but the stores of his mind." He was cheered by an old couplet he had learned in childhood. "When house and land is gone and spent, then learning is most excellent." It was armed with his learning alone, his few papers, his hammer and his acid bottle, his magnifying glass and compass, a theodolite and a chain, and in the company of his half-crazy wife Mary Ann and his 19-year-old nephew John Phillips, that Smith then boarded the night coach for the Great North Road. He owned no property. He had no home. His only achievements, his map, and the atlas that would be published on the very day he travelled, brought him no income to speak of. He was penniless, homeless, out of work, and, in comparison with the gentlemen of the Geological Society, both out of fashion and out of favour. He would get down from the coach 3 days later, in the windswept Yorkshire town of North Allerton, in an effort to rebuild there his life as a nomad, to wander northern England in search of a means of earning a living. In the event, he was to spend the rest of his life in the North Country. He was to find work there, and in that uncertain labour, satisfaction of a kind. And in due course he was also to find vindication, when, after a dozen years of the hand-to-mouth existence of a fugitive journeyman, he returned to London for a lengthy stay, he re-entered his capital in triumph, and he was showered with the honours, gratitude and recognition that had for too long been steadfastly denied him. Though he did not know it when he stepped down from the Northern Mail on that bleak early autumn morning, the tide that had challenged his life was in due course, though some long time off, assuredly going to turn. The Lost and Found Man. In the fractious and rebellious days of late 18th century Ireland, it would have been foolhardy, to say the very least, for a young man to carry in his bag a sharp hammer, a magnetic compass, and a bottle of hydrochloric acid. For William Fitton, who was an 18-year-old student in Dublin at the time, it was positively dangerous. The English soldiers who found him, hammer and compass in hand, and who promptly arrested him on the quite reasonable suspicion of his being what would later be called a Fenian subversive, took a great deal of persuading that he was in fact merely a student of the newfangled science of geology. His explanation, that the menacing-looking items in his bag were no more than the tools of his trade, was not something the troops of Empire were eager to believe in 1798. But then the authorities at Trinity College interceded on his behalf, and Fitton was released. He resumed his studies, behaved more prudently as the rebellions raged away outside his college, and by the end of the century had taken a degree. He worked only for a short while as a field geologist, in Ireland itself, as well as in Wales and Cornwall. It seemed to him an arduous way of making a living. And in time he made his way to Edinburgh, took a degree there in the less controversial field of medicine, and after a spell in London established himself in Northampton as a doctor, specialising in the study and treatment of pneumonia. His fascination with geology never left him, though. He joined the Geological Society, demonstrating in his papers and debates, and with his furious clashes with men like George Greenough, whom he regarded as enemies, both intellectual and social, that already the time of the dilettante was over, that science was in the ascendant, and that good men were in the process of taking charge of a new field of study that Fitton and his like believed was coming to be of truly profound importance. It was his determination to see that good men won due acclaim that led Fitton to become the instrument through which William Smith, whom he first met in November 1817, eventually won the recognition and reputation he had long deserved. Fitton, in short, was the means by which the tides of Smith's fortune began to turn, except that by the cruelest stroke of fate his efforts began to bear fruit only at the very moment that the poor man was about to suffer his greatest humiliation in the King's Bench debtor's prison. By 1815 Fitton was already a well-respected member of England's scientific establishment. He had a solid medical practice. He was a close friend of men like the near-ubiquitous Sir Joseph Banks. He had been elected to the Royal Society, and he had married well and had a considerable fortune. He was, despite being only 35, a man of influence, and when in 1817 he asked to be put in touch with William Smith to see the nature of his work, a ripple of interest stirred the waters of intellectual London. Smith's diary, which is erratic at the best of times, notes only that a meeting was arranged for early December, but hints that Fitton himself never came. Others of Smith's allies did, however, and for a while afterwards a small barrage of papers made their way around the learned journals of London, trying to establish Smith's credentials as the creator of stratigraphy and the creator of the map that had been on sale now for the past 2 years. None of these efforts seems to have done Smith much good. His financial situation did not improve. His standing with the Geological Society did not change. His acceptance into the salons of London's intellectual demi-monde remained on hold. John Ferry had made generous mention of Smith's working progress 10 years before in the pages of the Monthly Magazine and the Philosophical Magazine, and in Abraham Rees's Cyclopaedia. but none of these efforts seemed to have enhanced Smith's standing, and it looked more than likely that this new blizzard of panegyrics was going to be similarly ineffectual. It was not until the early summer of the following year that a wider public began to sit up and take notice. Only a very small number of appreciative people began to take Smith seriously, and not enough still to avert his impending disaster. But the mood in the middle of 1818 most definitely began to change, and it did so purely because of William Fitton, because he did write his assessment, and a glowing assessment it was, of Smith's work, and he saw to it that it was published in one of the country's most respected journals of the day, the Edinburgh Review. His paper, which he entitled Notes on the History of English Geology, was only 7 pages long, but short though it was a concentrated tincture of approbation. It looked almost entirely at Smith's contributions to the new science. It examined in a disinterested way, but in detail, everything of importance that had Smith's name on it, the great map, the memoir that accompanied it, the first volume of the Illustrated Catalogue of the British Fossils, the second volume of which was published the day after he was released from prison, the small geological cross-section between Snowdon and London, drawn on the side of the large wall map, and the first proofs of the first of Smith's 17 large-scale county maps, which were to be published by John Carey over the coming 6 years, and which Fitton, cunningly and without Smith's knowledge, had managed to get to see. The paper was an almost undiluted paean, a document that was destined, though probably not designed, to delight Smith in what was turning out to be the most troubled period of his life. Fitton had examined everything in the closest detail, and had written a considered criticism, noting errors, questioning judgments, criticizing lapses. But overall, the tone was that of a man overjoyed by the serendipity of the experience, the enthusiastic pleasure of a man who has discovered a rare and special talent. William Smith, Fitton told his readers, was a most ingenious man, whose only fault was that he had been singularly deficient in the art of introducing himself to public notice. There could be no doubt but that William Smith was performing work that constituted a truly historical development in the evolution of an entirely new science. He did not go so far as to suggest that Smith's map would change the world, but the implication in the paper was undeniably that, with the appearance of this immense and beautiful document, the world of commerce, of industry, of agriculture, and of intellectual endeavour would never be quite the same again. A year later, though, Smith was a destroyed man, fleeing London for good and for ever, or so he supposed, disillusioned, bitter, the victim of those he claimed were cheats and scientific pilferers. So what if William Fitton had been so kind as to write with such generosity of spirit? His doing so had made no essential difference. His fine words had manifestly buttered no parsnips. The map, now 3 years before the public, still hadn't sold as well as he had hoped. The quarry had gone bankrupt. The landlord had foreclosed on his mortgage and had called in a long-owed debt. The bailiffs had done their worst. He had been turfed out of the Buckingham Street house. His goods and chattels had been confiscated and sold, and now he was in Yorkshire, 200 muddy miles away from London, and heartily glad, if, that is, he knew the meaning of gladness, to be there. Smith was never to own a home again, never to settle anywhere other than as a tenant. As John Phillips was to write about his uncle with all the timbre of a true Victorian melodramatist, from this time, for 7 years, he became a wanderer in the north of England, rarely visiting London except when drawn thither by the professional engagements which still, even in his loneliest retirement, were pressed upon him and yielded him an irregular, contracted, and fluctuating income. It was 7 long years of nights at inns and coaching stations, and weeks in cheap lodging-houses in towns and villages as far-flung as Doncaster and Kirkby Lonsdale, Sheffield and Heskett Newmarket, Bennett Thorpe and Durham Town. There was a curiously surreal, gypsy-like contentment to some of these years, which his nephew hinted at when he wrote, soon after they began their self-imposed exile. In the winter of 1819, Mr. Smith, having perhaps more than usual leisure, undertook to walk from Lincolnshire into Oxfordshire. According to an established custom on all such tours, he was employed in sketching parts of the road and noticing on maps the geological feature of the country. The object proposed was to pass along a particular line through the counties of Rutland, Northampton, Bedford, and Oxford, but the ultimate destination was Swindon in Wiltshire. We crossed in a day's easy walk the little county of Rutland, reached the obscure village of Gretton on the edge of Rockingham Forest. Whatever may now be the accommodations at this village, they were very wretched in 1819, December, but the odd stories of supernatural beings and incredible frights which were narrated by the villagers assembled at the little inn greatly amused Mr. Smith. The pursuit of geology, apparently for its own sake alone, was never far from Smith's mind. The road up Bosiade Hill, his nephew continued, now writing of the pair's time in Northamptonshire, was mantled with fossiliferous stone, some of which, obtained from the hilltop, was believed to be Kellaway's rock, and was found to contain Ammonites sublevis and other fossils. A fine specimen of this ammonite was here laid by a particular tree on the roadside, as it was large and inconvenient for the pocket, according to the custom often observed by Mr. Smith, whose memories for localities were so exact that he has often, after many years, gone direct to some hoard of nature to recover his fossils. Day after day there was the same goading restlessness about Smith, picking up, as he would for 7 long years, a little work here, leaving his calling card at some great hall or grange or castle there, endlessly looking up old acquaintances in the search for work or contacts or rooms for the night, his journals always filled with references to local geology, with narratives of local lore, and lovingly noting his occasional encounters with famous men, as with Adam Sedgwick, the godfather of the Ordovician and co-identifier of the Devonian, whom he met in Kirkby Lonsdale, and with the great Oxford geologist William Buckland, whom he met on this very walking trip, and whose eccentric decency came to figure prominently, along with Sedgwick's, in the next and more gloriously culminating chapter of William Smith's life. There was during this period an absence of any sustaining central core to his life. There was no home, no family, no single glorious project, except for completion, which never happened actually, of the series of county maps. He did a little work on these each time he went south to London, where he'd see John Carey, he'd take cheap rooms in Charing Cross, and knuckle down to colouring the new information he had gleaned onto a series of charts and cross-sections that, when seen today, are more beautiful than anything he did before. These cross-sections have found particular favour in the United States, where they can be seen in a popular poster published in Oklahoma. Certain of his county maps in reproduction can be bought today in London, but the half-dozen or so that are for sale hint at another of the melancholy realities of Smith's life, that though he had the time, and presumably the energy, and though he had the assistance of a young nephew of ever-increasing ability, he did little during this period of his life of any real merit, and rarely finished the greater projects that he had started in the years before. It was almost as though he wanted to shrug off the work he had already accomplished, to live off the reputation he had won from it, but not to return to it, in case he suffered the same measure of disappointments from it that had dogged him all his life so far. He became fond, however, of two particular places during his long sojourn in the north. One, the seaside town of Scarborough, has today a charming, if rather vague, remembrance of his long association with it. He first went there in 1820, just a year after his exile began. He had been asked by the town corporation to see if he could advise them on improving the water supply, a task he accomplished with ease. But what impressed him most about the town was its setting, its fresh sea air, its obvious charm, all of which might help improve the health of his wife, still deteriorating fast. Phillips, who rarely wrote about Mary Ann Smith, includes a line that speaks volumes for this fraught period in his uncle's life. He had come to this romantic and delightful town in hope to soothe the mental aberration of his wife, which became very manifest in this year. "I went to Scarborough," Smith was to write in his attempt at an autobiography, "under distressing circumstances, unknown to anyone in the place but through the medical men." But then he uncovered a happy chance about the population of the town, and noted in his journal that everyone here is very fond of talking on geology. Within only a few weeks, his temper improved. His apprehension of finding himself friendless and alone had abated. Within weeks he had won himself a circle of admiring and intelligent friends. He wrote that he found the people, provincial and unlettered Yorkshiremen though they might be, and by London standards innocent and artless folk, to be a constant delight. They had no side about them, he said. They accepted him for what he was. They made him welcome. They provided him with intellectual stimulus. And most important, their evident pleasure at having so clever a man in their midst enabled him to renew a sense of self-esteem that had been soundly battered during his unhappy creative years in the nation's capital. He completed his detailed geological map of Yorkshire while there. It was published in 1821. He also began offering lectures, a guinea for a series of 9, a single lecture for 3 shillings, and with his nephew turned himself for a while into a highly profitable travelling road show. He pitched his tent, as it were, in York, Leeds, Hull and Scarborough, time and again, offering the latest information and the most up-to-date arrangements of organic fossils for the improvement of the minds of all. It was when he was off to give a course of lectures in Sheffield, for 60 much-needed pounds, that he was first troubled by the only illness he ever seems to have had, a curse of his peculiar trade. The notes for his possible autobiography record the moment. On sallying out from my winter quarters on a sunny day in March, and in hammering a long time for the fossils, in blocks of the cornbrash rock at the back of the Castle Hill, I so caught the rheumatism, which was the worst complaint I ever experienced, being 6 weeks confined to my bed in great pain, and the loss of the use of both my legs, though all the time in perfect health and good spirits. He was determined to make his assignment in Sheffield. He had the stagecoach brought to the front door of his inn, and demanded that 2 men tumble me in like a sack of potatoes. He had to support himself on his arms during the 50 miles of the journey, but sang songs to keep himself cheerful. On arriving at the Sheffield Junction, he tried to get up, fell like a child, and had to be carried off in a sedan chair. He gave his lectures. They were well attended. He collected his money. But that evening he mused for the first and only time that he might perhaps now give up geology for good, rheumatic joints being the principal curse of a field explorer, and keep a school. It was an idea, though, that vanished just as fast as it arrived. Geology still managed to exert its powerful magnetism on the man. And by now Smith was finding Scarborough so congenial that he was coming back time and again, whether for a commission or not. He returned first for a 2-year stay in 1824, lodging with a family called Williamson, who later wrote that Smith and his eccentric wife established themselves in our house, where they dwelt for a considerable time. Before long, Smith also made a very considerable physical impact on the town. He helped, most notably, to set up the Scarborough City Museum, a curious rotunda of a building that was finished in 1829, and that still stands on the town's seafront, though in much reduced condition. Smith's idea was radical. He had called for the building to be designed. It was built in the Doric style, 50 feet high and nearly 40 in diameter, with a spiral staircase and a graceful dome, so as to allow thousands of fossils to be arranged on shelves around the outer walls, all in their proper relative positions. The younger remains, in other words, were to be displayed on shelves at the top of the building, while the older fossils were deeper down, nearer the base. The youngest members from the Cretaceous would be at the top, the oldest fossils from the Trias would be at the bottom, all of them arranged just like the strata lying deep in the earth outside, just as the strata were arranged elsewhere in North Yorkshire, in exactly the same order as the rocks in faraway Dorset, and no doubt just as the rocks were arrayed, Cretaceous up above, Trias down below, in all the distant corners of the world beyond. It was a beguilingly clever idea. The members of the Scarborough Philosophical Society, a number of such local institutions were being set up all around the country at this time, designed for the dissemination of knowledge about science, were all hugely enthusiastic. They quickly agreed to fund the venture, and within weeks they had backed Smith with a handsome subscription. Building started swiftly, and it was finished inside a year. There was a gala opening, with 60 for dinner, the table being spread with every delicacy of the season, and with a fine dessert and excellent wines. The idea at first worked fabulously well, and for a while anyone who was interested in the paleontology of Yorkshire, which has some of the best fossil locales in the country, particularly rich in ammonites and dinosaurs, was compelled to make a pilgrimage to the curious little drum-shaped building by the sea, in which was housed one of the most perfect fossil collections in England. But in recent years the building has become a tawdry and half-forgotten little structure, the only relic of Smith being an indifferent reproduction portrait and a diorama painted around the upper floors, probably by John Phillips. There's a memorial stone on an outside wall mentioning Smith as having helped conceive the idea. There are no fossils in the Scarborough Rotunda any more. Smith's shelves are filled merely with indifferent items of junky memorabilia. He went off surveying and draining in the Midlands once the museum was up and running, and spent 6 years away. He came back again to Scarborough in 1834, and though he only rented a small house called Newborough Cottage on Bar Street, he was happy enough to put down roots, so far as he could, and to stay in the town for what turned out to be the rest of his days. A letter he wrote to his niece Anne survives. "I am now busy in partly furnishing a neat cottage situated in the midst of pleasure ground and walks laid out by Marshall, the tasteful designer and author of Rural Economy. We have two parlours and a kitchen, cellar and other conveniences, three good bedrooms with two staircases and attics. Shall have possession on Monday. Rent, £15 a year. You may therefore direct to me in future at Newborough Cottage, Scarborough. The place was occupied by the late Mrs. Eastwood, aunt to Mr. Hall, who kindly undertakes to convey this intelligence to you. I shall have plenty of room to spread out manuscripts, maps and fossils, and in this snug retreat for doctors and philosophers I shall be happy to see you and the professor whenever you choose to come." The letter was written in October 1835. Smith was by then a man of 66, and, as the letter suggests, was slipping gracefully and, at long last, contentedly into his old age. And contentedly is the key word here, for something significant by now had happened to change his mood and his temper. The train of events that brought him to a new state of untroubled happiness began at the one other Yorkshire site in which he spent time, and where he experienced the epiphany that was to redirect, and for so much the better, the course of his remaining life. The pretty village remains more or less unchanged since Smith was there during the 6 years from 1828 until 1834. It's no more than 6 miles inland from Scarborough, hidden deep in a fold of the hills in the valley of the River Derwent. It is called Hackness, and it and the rolling hills around it have for years been the fiefdom of a family of lowland Scots called Johnstone, a family that would come to have an inestimable impact on the life of the old geologist who came for a while to stay among them. Sir John Vanden Bempty Johnstone, as Dutch blood liberally mixed in with the Scots, was described by his biographer as a sincere friend to geology and natural history. He had joined the Geological Society, was a keen collector of fossils, as well as being an MP, first for Weymouth in Dorset, and then for Scarborough, spanning in his legislative responsibilities both ends of England's main Mesozoic outcrop. When, as a baronet, the Johnstone family of Hackness was not to become ennobled for a further 80 years, Sir John succeeded to the Yorkshire estates, he decided to convert to practical effect on his farms some of the geological and botanical truths which he knew to have been established in the museum and the laboratory. He knew of William Smith from meeting him at the Philosophical Society meetings in Scarborough. He had actually contributed, gratis, the stone for the building of the rotunda, and in 1828 he hired him as his land steward. He gave him the use of a vicarage close to where Hackness Grange now stands as a hotel, and for the 6 following years Smith lived as pleasant a life as can be imagined, meditating, writing, living, as Phillips noted with some asperity, like a happy farmer, and performing only one task of geological significance, making a beautiful, large-scale and fully hand-coloured map of the Hackness estate, which hangs today in pride of place in the hall, the big house, having survived a fire that raged through most of the rest of the house early in the last century. all passing geologists of note now suddenly took great care to stop at Hackness, both to see Smith and to congratulate his patron, this sincere friend to geology, for taking care of the kindly old man who now bumbled amiably around his estates. One of those who visited was the Derbyshire-born chemist and lens-maker William Vernon, who came by in 1826. It was precisely at this time that the first suggestions were made that William Smith's contribution to geology should somehow be formally recognised. Whether Vernon first put the idea in Johnstone's mind, or whether, as the romantic view maintains, the enlightened nobleman actually suggested it to Vernon, remains unclear. But what is known indicates the subsequent chain of events. William Vernon dashed off a letter to Roderick Murchison, the Scottish soldier who had established himself as one of the great architects of geology, the founder of the Silurian period, and, with Sedgwick, co-founder of the Devonian. In this letter Vernon said, as forcefully as courtesy allowed, "Smith has dedicated his life to geological inquiries, and has done perhaps more than any individual for the science, and is at an advanced age in poverty and dependence. There has been nothing in his conduct or character to diminish the respect due to his exertions in the cause of knowledge, and the compassion which his circumstances excite. I have thought a subscription might be raised, a small annuity purchased for him, sufficient to secure his not dying in the poorhouse. I should be much obliged to you if you would do what you can to forward it. I am sure you'll find many able and willing friends to this project in Dr. Buckland and many other members of the Geological Society." The mills of the Geological Society grind exceeding slow. There was still some opposition among the old guard, the anti-Smith alliance of Greenough and his friends, who had seen to it that as late as 1822 Smith was still denied even membership of the organisation. But this was now changing, and rapidly. A new breed of scientists was directing the Society's affairs these days, scientists who accorded as much honour to the practical men, the men who went out into the field in the damp and chill, and happily dirtied their hands in the finding of facts, as to the theorists and the thinkers in what was, after all, a fundamentally practical field of study. Vernon's appeal, or perhaps it was Sir John Johnstone's appeal, fell on ears that were fully attentive. All agreed that some distinction should be given to Smith. The only question was the timing. The feeling that, given the continuing power and influence of Greenough's faction, it would be imprudent to make an immediate move. Smith was content, employed, more or less free from financial woes. Matters could await a while longer. But by the time Adam Sedgwick was settled in the chair of the Society 4 years later, it was time to move. All of a sudden, and at long, long last, the most powerful and influential body of geologists in the world could right the wrongs it had done to Smith during the past quarter century. It would summon the old man down from Yorkshire to London. It would garland him with the greatest honours it had in its power to bestow. Now was the time for the scientific establishment to beg forgiveness and to offer to William Smith his long-overdue reward for what was officially recognised as one of the most memorable of human achievements. All honour to the Doctor. A medal shall be struck in fine gold, not exceeding the value of 10 guineas, and it shall have on its obverse side the bust, to the left, and to the right, Wollaston. It was just before Christmas, 1828, that William Hyde Wollaston died in London at the age of 62. 2 weeks earlier he had written a formal letter to the Geological Society announcing that he was planning to make a bequest of £1,000 worth of stock, in the hope that an award might be created. The first year's income would be for making the die, and handed out each year to one individual for his or her research into the mineral structure of the earth. It was in some ways an odd choice. William Wollaston was not a geologist, but a chemist, though said by all to be a man blessed with the most acute powers of observation. He could apparently see even the tiniest of flowers while riding on horseback. He invented the camera lucida, after noticing something odd in the crack in his shaving mirror. He was one of the few men who ever noticed a mirage on the River Thames. He was a doctor, an expert on kidney stones and on mineral-based enlargements of the prostate. He specialized in the chemistry of exotic and precious heavy metals. He discovered palladium, and from its rose-colored salts, refined rhodium. He made a fortune from finding clever new ways of working with platinum. He invented the reflecting goniometer, an instrument that could measure the precise angles between the faces of microscopic-sized crystals. And during his lifetime he published no fewer than 56 academic papers on pathology, physiology, chemistry, optics, mineralogy, crystallography, astronomy, electricity, mechanics and botany, but made not a single contribution to the science of geology itself. He has, however, a mineral named after him, a calcium silicate called wollastonite, which is formed when limestone is crushed hard against another rock. But his medal, awarded every year since 1831, is without peer in the world of geology. To be a recipient of the Wollaston Medal is to become the equal of a Nobel laureate, in a discipline for which, despite its universal and elemental nature, and in common with mathematics, Alfred Nobel puzzlingly and shamefully left no bequest. The Wollaston is the Oscar of the world of rocks, fought for gamely, campaigned for bitterly, and if awarded, then accepted with the secure knowledge that career and reputation are guaranteed for life. Yet at the time the medal was struck, the science it sought to reward was still very much in its infancy. Physics, chemistry, and medicine had long been fully fledged. When Nobel offered his prizes for excellence in them, they had been around for centuries. Wollaston's bequest, on the other hand, was designed for practitioners of a science that had been totally unknown, at least by the name geology, a mere 6 decades before. And it was a science that, because of bigotry, intolerance, churchly disapproval, and the fundamental assumptions it sought to challenge, suffered more than the usual share of growing pains, pains that were mirrored precisely by the difficult evolution of the Geological Society itself. Set up when the science was just staggering to its feet, the Society was made up initially of men who had more pretense about them than solid achievement. In the outside world, said George Greenough, the term geology was little understood. Few men, beyond the pale of our little coterie, aspired, he said, to become geologists. The early members of the Society, or at least the more powerful among them, were bent more on following fields of elegant drawing-room fashion than pursuing and disseminating much rigorous scientific research. Most of them seemed blissfully unaware that there was in fact a very real and a profoundly important science buried within the aimless charms of their fossil and mineral collecting. So there was a good deal of tension, unanticipated at the time and yet with hindsight quite understandable, once the men of real worth, those who recognized that they were in at the beginning of a very real new science, began to rise through the Society's ranks. There was tension in particular once such men began not simply to rise, but to overwhelm and displace the smug little coterie whose fossil collector's dining club it originally was. In few sciences can there have been such an ugly rivalry. John Phillips, William Smith's nephew, first came to live full-time in London in 1831, and reported that he found it all vastly amusing, noting in his journal that the jealousy among the men of science here is wonderful. Others found it less so. Thomas Webster, who was the curator of the Society's museum, wrote that he was surrounded by a band of busy, jealous, active, and revengeful witlings who have gained and kept their ascendancy partly from contempt, partly from the indolence of others. George Greenough, who was president of the Society, was responsible for setting its early temper, had once been held in awe. Now he was being dismissed merely as a charlatan and a blockhead. Others, in his various factions, were described as quacks, jackals, and pilferers. Gradually, though, the passions subsided, and by the late 1820s the new elite was in place to remain unassailably there for many years. Controversies continued to rage, as in any stimulating environment, but thenceforth they tended to be about geological dogma and discovery, much less about money, influence, and class. The academic tone was rising by the day. Sedgwick and Murchison, the two colossi of the discipline, were now firmly in position, battling royally over such technical matters as the succession of the Lower Paleozoic. In place, too, was perhaps the most colourful and clever of all 19th-century geologists, the great showman scientist who preceded John Phillips as professor at Oxford, Dean William Buckland. Buckland is perhaps better known today for his antics than his discoveries and beliefs. He had a voracious need to check everything. He tried to eat his way through the entire animal kingdom, offering mice in batter and steaks of bison and crocodile to his guests at breakfast, but reserving the viler things for himself. He declared once that he found mole perfectly horrible, and the only thing worse was that fat English housefly, known colloquially as a bluebottle. His sense of taste seems not to have been ruined by such experimentation. He once found his carriage stranded in the night-time fog somewhere to the west of London, scooped some earth from the road and tasted it, and declared to his companions with relief, "Gentlemen, Uxbridge." He was a great sceptic, particularly where Catholics were concerned. Once led to a dark stain on the flagstones of an Italian cathedral, which the local prelate insisted was the newly liquefied blood of a well-known martyr, he dropped to his knees, licked the darkened spot, and announced that it was, in fact, the urine of bats. But above all, he was a field worker, a scrabbler about in meadows, a clamberer, a hammerer. His best-known discovery was of the thousands of broken bones in a cave in North Yorkshire. These he declared to indeed be evidence of the deluge, the flood. But since the bones it had swept up into the cave in cold, windy Yorkshire were those of tropical animals, hyenas, elephants, lions, the event had in fact happened many thousands of years ago, when the weather was tropical, and not, according to Usher's dogmatic timetable. The 6 days of creation were properly to be thought of as 6 ages, he said. Scientific observation had now displayed, without a shadow of doubt, that there was much more to the Bible than could be learned from its strict and literal interpretation. The new science of geology, in other words, was now capable of asking, and probably of answering, the truly great questions, the fathomless wonderment about God, the cosmos, and humankind. The conclusions to which Buckland, the keenest of all observers, eventually came, were to change the relationship between science and religion for all time. And geology, this brand new science, with a brand new society and now a brand new medal from Wollaston, was the key to the unlocking of thousands of years of fettered and blinkered prejudice. It was this holy trinity of geology's new young grandees, Sedgwick, Murchison and Buckland, none of them older than 45, who saw to it that it was William Smith who would be awarded the first ever of the Society's Wollaston medals. No matter that he was not a member of the Society and had never invited to be one, or that just 9 years beforehand his membership had been blackballed by Greenough's old guard, no matter that he was low-born, that he was uneducated, a provincial, a convicted debtor, and that even more contemptible of figures, a practical man. No matter that he had accused some of the more august members of the geological establishment of stealing his work, of cheating him of his due. No matter that a quarter of a century's worth of ill-feeling had accumulated, that factions existed and battled among themselves, and that the kingdom's entire geological universe had been upset. Now, the wise men decreed, was the time for atonement and reconciliation. The message had gone out from Sir John Johnstone at Hackness, via Mr. Vernon to Sir Roderick Impey Murchison, from Murchison to Dean William Buckland, and from Buckland to Adam Sedgwick, who was both Woodwardian Professor of Geology at Cambridge, and, since 1829, the Geological Society's president. The debate was brief. The die was cast. A formal resolution was passed at a special meeting of the Society's Council, without dissent, despite Greenough's Council membership, on January the 11th, 1831, both that the first medal be given to Smith, and that he should be granted the proceeds of Wollaston's so-called Donation Fund, established to provide a modest income to a scientist whose career, through no fault of his own, was, if the double pun may be permitted, on the rocks. William Smith was at Hackness when he was first given the momentous news, in a letter sent by hand from the Society. His excitement and delight are infectious. One can sense the pleasure, the new spring in his step, the feeling of relief and gratitude, and of a wrong being righted, at last. Last night I received Professor Sedgwick's official letter, he writes at the end of the month, to his nephew, who himself was now well on in his own distinguished career. He presses me to appear in person at the Society's anniversary on the 18th February, and where he would go through the form of being presented with the medal. The form was necessary, because in fact the medal itself was not finished when time came for the award, but the Society went ahead anyway, giving itself up to a state of what, for the geological world, is very close to rapture. At their meeting, every countenance glowed with delight, Smith wrote to his niece, when the 20-guinea purse was delivered to me. Then 90 merry philosophical faces glowed over a most sumptuous dinner at the Crown and Anchor. The new president, Mr. Murchison, took the chair. On his right sat Mr. Herschel, Sir John Johnstone, Professor Sedgwick, myself, Mr. Blake, Dr. Fitton. After drinking much success to their fellow associates in science, they drank my health, coupled with the numerous geological societies which now spot the range of the eulytic series, was given 3 times 3, which was truly drunk with enthusiasm. Old William Smith sounds to have been almost a little tipsy himself while writing this letter. But, disabled by drink or not, he had clearly remembered to see to it that Sir John Johnstone had been invited, so that the man who had rescued him from rural obscurity was on hand to watch the revels of his elevation to the corps d'élite of the nation's scientists. And, as Adam Sedgwick was to make clear, it was a corps d'élite with but one member. The closing paragraphs of his short speech are worth quoting at their high-flown length, not least because they include the one phrase, an injudicious hyperbole, some churlish few will say, that has since marked the memory of William Smith out for all time, and that remains carved on his headstone and in gilt letters on 12 public memorials. I, for one, can speak with gratitude of the practical lessons I have received from Mr. Smith. It was by tracking his footsteps, with his maps in my hand, through Wiltshire and the neighbouring counties, where he had trodden nearly 30 years before, that I first learned the subdivisions of our eulytic series, and apprehended the meaning of those arbitrary and somewhat uncouth terms which we derive from him as our master, which have long become engrafted into the conventional language of English geologists, and through their influence have been in part also adopted by the naturalists of the continent. After such a statement, gentlemen, I have a right to speak boldly, and to demand your approbation of the Council's award. And if it be denied us to hope that a spirit like that of Wollaston should often be embodied on the earth, I would appeal to those intelligent men who form the strength and ornament of the Society, whether there was any place for doubt or hesitation, whether we were not compelled by every motive which the judgment can approve and the heart can sanction, to perform this act of filial duty before we thought of the claims of any other man, and to place our first honour on the brow of the father of English geology. It was he that gave the plan and laid the foundations and erected a portion of the solid walls by the unassisted labour of his hands. I think it a high privilege to fill this chair on an occasion when we are not met coldly to deliberate on the balance of conflicting claims in which, after all, we may go wrong, and give the prize to one man by injustice to another, but to perform a sacred duty where there is no room for doubt or error, and to record an act of public gratitude in which the judgment and the feelings are united. William Smith, now 62 years old, slightly lame from rheumatism, a little deaf, but otherwise as fit and wiry as a field geologist has a right to be, sat beaming throughout. He made a short speech of thanks, noting that Sir Isaac Newton had been born on the oolite, and remarking on how the science of geology might have changed had he looked down at the ground instead of up at the apple, a remark that produced a clatter of, presumably polite, laughter, that enabled Smith to resume his place and hide my honoured head among the seated. Before he did so, however, he presented the Society with 3 documents that have remained in the Burlington House apartments ever since. He had discovered among his papers the original manuscript version of the table of strata he had dictated to Benjamin Richardson in Joseph Townsend's drawing-room 32 years before, and he had found his circular map of Bath, coloured in by hand in 1799, and he offered also one of his elegant precursors, drawn in 1801, to his great geological map of the nation. There were more lunches and dinners the following day. An artist was engaged to paint his portrait, and John Carey, who had published all the maps, atlases, and sections that were still on occasional sale in London, made Smith a present of a newly bought pair of silver-framed spectacles. And then Smith left London, heading first to Churchill, where he was born, and, despite never being much of a God-fearing man, going to church with all of his surviving family, where they engaged in presenting our bald heads in supplication to their Maker. A week later, and he was back in the icy fastnesses of Yorkshire, reunited with his wife, who he reported to be in tolerable health, although troubled by a head cold. The father of English geology was at long last able to rest on his laurels and begin the final chapter of his life as a revered elder statesman, at long last accorded his due and given the respect that his hitherto unsung achievements deserved.